I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. On today's show, I'll talk to author Chip Jacobs, whose latest book is Strange as It Seems, The Impossible Life of Gordon Zoller. Zoller was Jacobs' uncle, who suffered a horrible accident as a young man, but went on to live a life that could only have happened in Hollywood. And it did. Stick around, and be prepared to connect the dots to Popeye and Bozo the Clown cartoons, as well as movie director Ed Wood Jr. and his misbegotten classic B-film, Plan 9 from Outer Space. If you're determined to title your book Strange as It Seems, you damn well better deliver. Well, Chip Jacobs does that and more in a loving, funny, and well-written biography of his late uncle, Hollywood musical legend Gordon Zoller. What makes it so strange? Well, in 1940, when Gordon Zoller was a 14-year-old daredevil who believed more than most teenage boys that he could do anything, a misadventure with a high school gymnastic springboard landed him on his neck and severed his spine. Most everyone, classmates, doctors, and family, presumed he would be dead in a matter of days. Now, for inexplicable reasons, Zoller survived. Now, scratch that, the quadriplegic thrived. He refused to roll over and die, instead taking charge of his Hollywood composer father's music catalog to create the go-to music library for early low-budget TV and film producers. All the time and money his family devoted to him early on eventually paid off. Zoller created a successful business with nothing more than a charismatic sales pitch. Eventually, he became friends and business associate of I Love Lucy star and producer Lucille Ball, Woody Woodpecker creator Walter Lantz, and animal-oriented TV show producer Ivan Tors, you know, Gentle Ben and Flipper, stuff like that. And right about now, you're thinking, this sounds like the pilot, like the plot to a Hollywood movie, Zelig starring Woody Allen, or perhaps Forrest Gump with Tom Hanks. But it's a true story. One that Zoller's nephew, Chip Jacobs, lived firsthand at the end of his uncle's life and later researched and reported in Strange as It Seems, The Impossible Life of Gordon Zoller. Chip Jacobs, welcome to Mr. Media.
Oh, I'm flattered to be here. Thank you so much. And I thought the lead-in was just perfectly on cue.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
Musical terms.
And no, we don't need to call PolitiFact in to do any corrections yet, right?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. So, Chip, surely you can understand how some people will hear a description of your Uncle Gordon's life and find it as believable as the baseball legend of Sid Finch, a scam perpetrated in 1985 by George Plimpton upon the readers of Sports Illustrated?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, some people usually scoff and or give me a funny eyebrow scrunched look when I tell them he did these things that he did. He looked at his injury like some people look at a skin rash and said, okay, deal with it. I want to go on my boat, take flying lessons, or what about a safari? Yeah, that was the key partly to his success. He just never looked down at his body. He just looked out at what he could do and fill his day with.
You know, this easily could have been fiction. You could have just, told people that you took some facts from life and you made a novel out of it. Mm-hmm. Because it's utterly preposterous, but there it is. It's real.
It is. But I mean, absurdity is a great way to live your life. So it took me a while as a writer to actually trust the story and trust that people could see it was all real and build up one step at a time into the parallel universe of Gordon Zoller. It's still a battle to get people to believe the things that he did actually occurred. And I'm sure I'm missing a couple dozen really even better stunts because he's passed on and I can't, I'm not a big believer in seances. So it has been a challenge to get people, including myself initially, to really accept, my God, this guy really did these things. And I'm related. How fantastic.
All right, so let's put this in – let's give this kind of a time frame for people.
Sure.
Gordon was 14 in 1940 when he had the accident. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yes.
And then he actually – I don't think we're giving anything away here. He lived in this condition for 35 years. Is that right?
He absolutely did. You know, if you've seen the Dallas Buyers Club, one of my favorite movies, and the hero talks about how long he survived with a deadly infection, and I just shake my head and go, well, that's pretty cool, but my uncle lived 35 years. He really was not expected to live 2 weeks.
Right.
And this grim prognosis seemed to shadow him really the rest of his life, but especially the first few years after he got hurt in this gym accident. And it colored lawsuits my grandparents filed against a school district. It connected to whether people thought he should have schooling or not. In a way, it was like, well, why waste our time with a dead guy or a soon-to-be dead boy? And, you know, my uncle heard a lot of this poor mouthing and funeral plot expectation, and it built up in him a great energy to show people wrong in spades.
And then the other part of framing this, how old were you? Well, so Gordon passed, I guess, around 75?
Correct.
Right? So yeah. You were how old in 75?
I was a 14-year-old, flippant tongue, trouble-causing teenager, much like my uncle had been when he planted himself into the gym mat. So, yeah, I was a teenager bristling against my mother's insistence that I come and say goodbye to him. I'd be nice to him. And I just wanted to, you know, back when you're 14, 15, 16, you know, you really crave normalcy. Most children do, and I did. And Gordon was sort of the elephant man of the family, and I really wanted nothing to do with them. You know, I wanted to be causing trouble outside a hospital room.
And when did – and we're going to come back and talk about Gordon's life in a second. But when did it change for you? When did – you know, after Gordon was gone, when did you start to realize – what you had there? I mean, certainly no 14-year-old appreciates anything. I've got a 19 going on 20-year-old who really, you know, oh, Dad, you're such an idiot. You know, I mean, you're not expected at 14 to appreciate these things. How long did it take for you to start thinking that Gordon was not just a story, but something special?
I would say the pivotal moment came in October of 93 when there was bad wildfires all over Southern California. Part of my parents' property, and my mom was Gordon's sister, part of that property burned down. And in this kind of boathouse or auxiliary, little personal warehouse for heirlooms, my grandfather's organ burned down. And this organ had been with my grandfather, Gordon's father, for years and years and years. It sort of signified the Hollywood legacy of a family. And without the music produced off that organ, which Gordon later repurposed after the whole family was destroyed by his accident, I don't think Gordon would have had a career. I don't know if I would be here in this form. And my mom, though she was happy their, you know, their house didn't get burned down in this 93 fire, she was so devastated by the loss of this organ and what it meant to Gordon's life, to family memory, to, you know, what was meaningful in this world. I actually thought she needed medical attention. And it did plant a seed in my mind. I was a journalist at that time. There is really a mystery here right under my nose I have to solve. I've been an investigative journalist and prided myself on uncovering stories others didn't. And yet I had this whopper right in front of me. And I barely knew anything about it except for, you know, kind of bad scalded memories with my uncle and a few scrapbook, pieces of knowledge that my mom had shown me. So it was really then. And then, you know, as years went by afterwards, my mom got this idea where she was convinced I should be the biographer of Gordon. And she kind of started a mom campaign on me using guilt, intrigue, and occasional veiled references.
A mom using guilt. I have trouble imagining that. What is that like?
It's this new thing.
All right. So I wanted to frame for people Gordon, the kind of the span of Gordon's life and then where you got involved. So let's go back now and talk a little about, first of all, Gordon as a 14-year-old. This was a kid who believed he could do pretty much anything, that the world couldn't touch him. Can you talk a little about that?
Absolutely. Gordon had a very wild spirit. It wasn't a malicious streak, but it was a wild spirit. And he was a type of kid that did have an adrenaline junkie pulse. And so where you and I might see some incredible ladder over a pool and go, God, I would never jump off that, he was drooling to jump off that. And in fact, he jumped off this towering indoor pool a few years before his accident at what's called the Venice Plunge. He would jump off piers. He would ride his bike off roofs. He also had a extremely a troublemaking, hell-raising element to his personality, and he liked to get a rise out of cranky adults. He found dynamite caps with his buddies and taped them to the trolley tracks near his house. And when the trolley or interurban rail went over, it would explode. And of course, the conductor, you know, picture this guy in a suit, a dark uniform with a little cap, he would go apoplectic. And sometimes he would stop a train and look for my, you know, rapscallion uncle and his friends to, you know, bust them. My uncle, did things like this. He sent whiskey to the teetotaling Presbyterian minister in town. He would cut up newspapers and put them on hedges of cranky old people. You know, he did like getting a rise out of people. Maybe it was something narcissistic in him, attention loving, but he did like to push the envelope, and most times he got away with it.
It was kind of a cross between Dennis the Menace and more modern Jackass.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, with Jackass, you know, my uncle would be his own YouTube phenom for sure.
You should probably get a copy in the hands of, I can't think of the guy who was the lead in the Jackass films.
No, that's a good idea. Yeah. I'll make a mental note as we spoke. Yeah, that's a good idea. He was, you know, people warned my grandparents, if he keeps this up, Gordon's going to land himself in big trouble. He's going to kill somebody, you know, with a prank on a ride, or he is going to kill himself. And lo and behold, that was pretty prophetic.
Yeah, so let's talk about what actually happened. He's a 14-year-old. He's in high school gym, and
right.
There's a whole big court case about this that comes after. But
yes.
Tell folks a little about what happened.
Well, Gordon had been thrown out of his previous school for shenanigans. Big surprise. He's 6 weeks into ninth grade at John Marshall Junior High in Pasadena. It already has been warned by the coach, and as well as his buddies, and they called themselves the Tarzans because Tarzan was the hot movie idol back then, not to do this one stunt where they ran down a ramp, hit a springboard, and try to vault over a pommel horse and grab some gymnast rings. However, on this one rainy day, there was a bad outbreak of athlete's feet in his school class, and so the coach was checking everybody for athlete's feet, and that meant the kids that he'd already cleared could go out and run and be by themselves in the gym. And you tell some teenagers don't do it, and you might as well just put catnip, you know, in their locker. And so they started doing this stunt where they ran down a line, hit a springboard, and tried to jump over a pommel horse. They stacked with blankets to hit, go higher and higher. Who could win the challenge? And my uncle demanded that he get the first crack at the school record. And he ran down this ramp. He hit the springboard. It was not in good condition. His foot slightly caught on one of the pommel horse handles, and it completely skewed his jump. And he missed grabbing the rings and instead went down head first and corkscrewed his neck into the gym pads, leaving him in this very unnatural position.
And part of the horror of that was made a little worse in the lawsuits that followed was that the coach, who probably in his mind thought he was doing a good thing by he didn't see the full picture. It's like not seeing the forest for the trees. He thought he could get away with leaving these kids unsupervised while he focused on, let's make sure we don't send these kids out into the world with athlete's foot.
That is true. The coach misjudged what was important. In the lawsuit that my grandparents later filed, I don't think the coach was even – the coach was just called negligent. Nobody called him out for moving Gordon. And in a way, that wasn't his fault because their understanding of spinal cord injury was so primitive back then. But they did blame the school for saying, hey, you had a springboard that didn't work. You had kids, you know, frolicking where they shouldn't have been. You had a turnbuckle too close. And all these things added up to a very dangerous condition. And, you know, back then, even today, you know, it was considered very unpatriotic suing a school district. And my grandparents got a lot of heat, like, you know, you've got a lot of gumption doing this. Your kid, you should have restrained your kid, and now you're pointing the finger at a public entity. So, yeah, it was horrifying. And I was, quote, lucky enough to be able to go and interview some of Gordon's old classmates to talk to them about this accident. And a few of them still, you could see them replaying it in their minds, even when these people were 70, 80, and they got pale and they got, you know, almost looks like some got nauseous. I mean, some things are indelible, and a memory of a kid laid out like an S is something you don't leave behind.
Oh, it's just brutal. And your grandfather initially thought, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Initially tried to pay the bills because the bills were just stacking up. If people think hospital bills are bad now, you would think that, well, it was $6 a day to be in the hospital. But, you know, you're only earning so much money a year and it adds up every day and there's this. And even x-rays then were, you know, still outpriced.
Well, yeah. One of the things that I was really astounded at was my grandfather was a longtime Hollywood studio musician. He worked on hundreds of projects. He created a really fantastic life for the family in Sierra Madre, Pasadena area. And yet it was all paper thin. It was all almost like a false Hollywood set. You know, when you see the facade of a building, right, and it's propped up by 2x4s if you look around back, that, in a way, was their lifestyle. You know, the idea there was a nest egg, like we're told to create today after the Great Recession. There was no HMO. There was no life insurance. There was no health insurance. You know, this great life where they could afford some amenities, it just went down the drain at a lightning speed. And I guess nobody anticipates having a child in intensive care for months after months after months. But that was the situation. And really, my grandfather came from very proud Hungarian stock. And he later had to apply for welfare provided through the Motion Picture Fund, which is a showbiz financed insurance pool for people that fall on hard luck. And I have the application, and I'm sure there's tears all over it. Mm-hmm. The idea that everything he built up was just so ephemeral and so, so wafer thin, it must have ate at him, and I'm sure it contributed to his early death.
Well, we'll come back to that in a second, but your mom was Gordon's older sister who was planning to go to college and had plans for herself. And just everything vanished with Gordon's injury. Everyone, the family had to take care of him. There was round-the-clock care required once he got out of the hospital.
Yep.
Your mother was told she couldn't go to college. She couldn't do the things that she thought she would be able to do. And yet, I mean, what's interesting is it seemed like early on there was some resentment and she was very frustrated by it. She left for a time. But she, you know, in the end, she's the one who convinces you to do this. She's the one who takes you to see her uncle, her brother. She came around full circle on that, didn't she?
She came around full circle. I think one of the cosmic reasons for me to write this story, and I almost got killed with my brother and my parents' housekeeper in the fire. We stupidly went up to think we could put it out, and it was a joke. But I think one of the reasons the stars, quote unquote, wanted me to do the story is they wanted me to understand why my mom was the way she was. And this kneecapped her potential, not going to college, not having more attention splashed on her. And, you know, when she and my uncle would get together, there was a very obvious, unreconciled negative energy between them that was kind of glossed over and whitewashed a bit. And, you know, it was cheery pleasantries. But I don't think they ever, quote, got real with each other and said, you know, my mom saying, you know, you veered my life away that away from where it could have gone. And he apologized. Maybe they said it. I don't know. But yes, my at first it was rally around Gordon. And, you know, my mom preached nothing but legacy and legend when she would talk about him. She never really would go, well, this guy, you know, he's the reason I didn't create a fuller identity for myself.
Why do you think Gordon didn't simply wither and die in the days and weeks following the accident? And do you have you found in the other, any other members of the family over the years who've had that kind of spark that he did? Maybe you do, for all I know. But it's a special kind of human being who could, you know, emotionally and mentally surmount what he did.
I don't think I have that tenacity personally to have survived it. There are other people that have sparks in the family. Unfortunately, until Gordon, they just had a habit of getting killed. You know, when you look behind Gordon's direct line of genealogy, there's all these other incredible people that would trust a stranger and get murdered, or including Gordon's grandfather, you know, be considered a genius, then come to the States and have to work doing manual labor because they just didn't have the tenacity. I think the same spark that fueled Gordon's mischief transformed into this incredible iron will and contrarian streak. Well, you think I can pull off that trick? I'm going to pull off the greatest feat of all, and I'm going to outlive every prognosis, and I'm going to do things that are going to make your jaw drop. And I think that became his gag. I do think in the hospital, when Gordon was fighting for his life, the Christian faith that my grandmother tried to beat into his head became real. And I think he had a Jesus moment, and I'm not trying to get overly religious, but I do think he knew there was another life with his legs restored he was going to have. So this one is just – so this life he was going to approach as cherry on a Sunday. He was not going to be in bed for a terribly long time. I mean, he initially, like a lot of people that are paralyzed, said, I'm going to get up once I can feel my legs again. But when he didn't feel his legs again, he said that was okay. And in fact, he needed at some point to have his spine fused, and the doctor gave him two options. I can fuse your spine in a way that's easier for you to lay back. This is stabilizing his spine, which has its benefits. Or it can fuse your spine so you're more sitting up, so you can see the world, you can be in a wheelchair more. But it's got its disadvantages because you're going to be, oddly shaped, almost like a half staircase. And Gordon said, I want to see the world, you know. So I think that kernel, that cold nugget of indomitable belief laid inside him the whole time. But the accident triggered it, and it came out. And, you know, when he left County General Hospital after like 9 months, some of it in terrible shape with metal pins drilled in his head, you know, it was a victory story that was as unlikely as any Ronald Reagan movie.
Do it for the Gipper. Before you were talking about your grandfather, Gordon's dad, who's a composer, he did film, he was very quick. It's interesting, you described that his world was kind of paper thin, that, you know, they weren't stockpiling money for this, and then, of course, everything was gone. It's really interesting to me that Gordon, a lot of things today, you can have one movie or one hit record today, and almost, in some cases, live the rest of your life on the profits of that, because it keeps earning. It can be used for different things. It accesses things. Does Gordon get credit for figuring out that there is, as they used to say, that gold in them thar hills? I mean, that his dad's musical legacy could actually provide for years to come?
That's an excellent question. That's part of the reason I wrote the book. You know, he, I don't think he gets credit for that. And to be honest with you, initially in the late 40s and 50s, after Lee passes away from the stress, and my grandma, it's just my grandmother and Gordon, this kid who got out of the hospital that was never supposed to, who liked to go out with his friends clubbing and get drunk. They would push his wheelchair or gurney into these clubs, and he would meet Nat King Cole, and then he'd come back to very dire circumstances. You know, I don't think he looked at it. I think he just looked eventually, after enough pity and charity, and looked at this closet where his dad's old tapes were, and think, this is a lifeline. This is a way for us to survive. This is a way for us to get out of this crummy apartment and be able to, you know, afford, you know, a couple grocery bags of food. Later, I think people copied Gordon in the idea of repurposing old music for TV, film, radio, you know, everybody is searching for the fountain of youth and immortality. Gordon, as a matter of survival, I think he saw that music in a way was immortal. And, you know, TV in the early 50s was so crude and so, you know, amateurish and so undeveloped. And producers knew there needed to be background music. They needed to put sound behind their skits, etc. Low-budget sci-fi directors did too. You know, they understood that the weaker the plot, the better the music and the fringe elements needed to be. Gordon did, like a laser beam, you know, light up that idea and said, aha, I have something I can sell to you. But I don't think he gets enough credit for being ingenious, for using the only darn thing he had, the only effing thing that he could muster to pay the bills, which is his dad's music. And eventually, you know, eventually he would buy other catalogs and would build and build and build on it. But, you know, it wasn't just an homage to his dad. His dad, in a way, kept them alive from the grave.
Well, it's funny. You were just talking about him buying other catalogs.
Right.
And I mean, Michael Jackson, that's why Michael Jackson thrived at a certain point. He bought the Beatles catalog.
He bought Paul McCartney's catalog. I'm a Paul McCartney fanatic, Beatles maniac, all that. Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, when Paul goes to heaven, Michael Jackson's going to be there at the pearly gates and he's saying his high-pitched, you know, falsetto, "See, Paul, I still have the royalties." Paul McCartney still goes, "The dumbest move I ever made." But, you know, this was a matter of life and death. I can't stress that enough. And it was a hard sell at first when Gordon went into Hollywood. His mom was pushing him around. He was a guy in his mid-20s. He looked like a skeleton with an oversized head. He kept his hands, which kind of became almost creepy, Creature of the Black Lagoon, curled in. Withered appendages that I never wanted to come near me. You know, it was a hard sell, and Gordon got the charisma, and he did have a natural salesmanship, bullshitting quality about him. And so he built up the Zoller music catalog into something wondrous, like it was something from George Gershwin's brain. So, you know, but it was, like I said, you know, they were looking at homelessness, you know, living around a soup kitchen. Had he not kind of thought, aha, this is our one chance. Reuse my dad's stuff and build on that.
Well, I mean, has it crossed your mind that he was able to repurpose his father's music into a whole another world? I mean, his father could have never imagined at the time this could happen. And here you are, years later, you found a way to repurpose Gordon's life into a book, and it seems to me that someone in Hollywood is gonna, if that hasn't already happened, is gonna have to seize on this as a great film project. I mean, you know, you've got we'll talk about this. They cross paths with, you know, Lucille Ball and Walter Lantz and Ivan Tors,
right.
It's like you know, someone who could envision. Crumb, you know, the R. Crumb story, and bring it to life in it's kind of differently. Some actor who's thinking, oh, this is my awards moment because I'm going to play Gordon Zoller and I have to emote everything from the neck up. I mean, you know, it just seems like it's got that written all over it, a Hollywood story.
I hope so. I would be I would be so delighted to see him get the credit he deserves. I'm hoping it, you know, will have some cinematic interpretation. I mean, you don't really find a lot of stories aside from Gordon's survival of the impossible and you know, running basically a locomotive into the side of Lee Zoller's lifestyle he created for his family. I mean, Gordon lived so crazily, you know, even if he started from 1950s and didn't even mention his dealings with Ed Wood, I think it would be so entertaining and inspiring, even though, you know, I do try to show the good and bad side and all the grayscale of life as a quadriplegic, where Gordon could sometimes afford to be blasé and indifferent about his paralysis. Those around him sacrificed everything. And my grandmother, you know, in a way, this is also a story about a mother's love, about the love of helping hands that aren't in the frame of the picture. Because my grandmother, you know, she'd seen her father murdered. She'd seen her brother murdered. She'd seen her husband pass away from stress. She'd seen her son paralyzed. I mean, really, this was Job, you know, in a flowery apron going on. And, I think a lot of moms and parents could definitely identify with what it takes to give your kid a chance to smell the fresh air of life. So, yeah, I'm hoping so. You know, I pay commissions, Bob. So, you know, if somebody sees something, you know, please hit me up. You know, it's really a great Hollywood story. And for a while, I thought, you know, there's a movie made about my uncle, I'm going to start the most ferocious guerrilla campaign to get him a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. As a reporter, I made all those people in Hollywood really hate my guts. But my uncle is going to be their kryptonite. They're going to have to give him a star. I mean, if you've seen the stars they have down there, you know, really, it would be funny because what, you know, he couldn't put his hands in any concrete. Maybe they'll have to use like a wheelchair track.
That would be great. That would be great. Let's talk about some of the Hollywood stardust that does land on this story.
Yeah, sure.
Let's say Walter Lantz. How does Gordon Zoller cross paths with the creator of Woody Woodpecker?
Very cunningly is the answer. This is the early 1960s. Gordon had done and was in the process of working on low-budget sci-fi. He had acquired a whole bunch of cartoons from Popeye to Bozo the Clown, not necessarily the best quality cartoons, but it's a paycheck. And so, you know, that was the key to surviving in Hollywood as an independent post-production guy, have a lot of things strung out, you know, always be working on your next project, understanding your current one may die off and get canceled. And Gordon, by the early 60s, was had enough money as well as the insanity to think, I really need a boat. And so he had a power boat. Down in the Balboa area, and he, a few boats over, one Saturday, he noticed Walter Lantz and his wife. Walter Lantz is was a contemporary of Walt Disney, extremely talented, driven, industrious guy, and he was kind of going towards the twilight of his career. He had this fancy yacht, not like a Bill Gates yacht, but a darn nice sized mini yacht. Gordon sees him over on a few slips away and realizes this guy could be my ticket to even the higher plateau. And so he intentionally picks a fight with one of his sound editors named Joe von Stroheim, whose dad was Eric von Stroheim, the famous silent picture director. He picks a fight with Joe. It's a very loud, you know, sarcastic ribbing that Gordon was giving Joe over painting in the boat. Joe storms off. Walter Lantz can hear their fighting and their yelling, and to all appearances to Walter Lantz, it looks like Gordon is by himself. He's been stranded on the boat. He didn't see Gordon's attendant inside, like cowering, I don't want to have anything to do with it. And he strikes up a conversation. Walter Lantz, being a good guy, says, hey, do you need help? I heard you're row with this guy. And Gordon schmoozes and plays it cool, even though he's probably sweating inside. No, it's cool. And Gordon effectively talks his way into an invitation onto Walter Lantz's yacht.
Well, let me just explain to people. We lost our connection, so we're picking up approximately where we left off. You were talking about Walter Lantz had started a conversation, I guess, across the boat. And then did he go over to Gordon?
What happened was my uncle's attendant, Jimmy, wheeled my uncle from the dock near the boat over to Walter Lantz's place. They got my uncle settled on the boat. Martinis were mixed. Crab cakes were served. And the salesmanship and hawking began. And, you know, Walter Lantz, like many people in Hollywood, saw something special about my uncle. And I don't think he was thinking, oh, what an inspirational story. And I feel so sorry for him. I want to throw him a few nickels. I think he thought, this guy's got some damn good ideas and I can make money off him and have more control over my material. Gordon did always pitch, you know, you have money in your pocket that you don't understand. He did appreciate that about music. So sure enough, Walter Lantz is nodding his head. And by the time that the editor that my uncle had infuriated came back, Walter Lantz and my uncle already had an informal deal to start the Walter Lantz Music Company.
Wow, that's amazing. And then where does Ed Wood fit into this? And for people who don't know who Ed Wood is, and I'm sure there's a few of them, I'll just say that Ed Wood was played by Johnny Depp in a movie of his life about the making of Plan 9 from Outer Space. That's who Ed Wood is. Anything more than that, you can go and look him up. But where does Gordon and Ed fit together?
Gordon was just having surgery or coming close to having surgery, really from an incident that where he died on the table, and he had bladder infection. There was an obstruction, and his heart stopped. And you know, they didn't have cardiac paddles then; they had to actually saw open his chest. He was just recovering from this near death experience, and he wasn't down. He felt like almost stronger than ever. See, I have a reason for being around. Ed Wood, the low budget director, one thing I like about Ed Wood is his sincerity and desire to be an auteur was infectious, and it far surpasses his actual ability. I mean, he wasn't really trained. He hit up my uncle in like the mid 50s to supply on the cheap music for this bizarre science fiction meets horror meets vampire story called Plan 9 from Outer Space. And Gordon said, I have just the music for you. I'm not sure Gordon did all the proper licensing. what he was doing was he was taking music produced by primarily English composers and cutting them up and to create a really good soundtrack to a really bad movie. In fact, the New York Times praises my uncle, saying it's actually kind of the best element of Plan 9. And Ed Wood wanted to do another job with him, with my uncle. The bad thing about working with Ed Wood, well, one of the bad things is besides having your name next to him, and barely any theaters would air this movie, he wouldn't pay up. And his company eventually went bankrupt, and Gordon, through his lawyers, and he's getting wealthier and wealthier, my uncle, so he could afford a Beverly Hills lawyer, he chased Ed Wood all around Hollywood trying to get him to pay up for his bill, and Ed Wood never would. I have the letters. Right before Ed Wood died in the late 70s, he wrote the liner notes to the soundtrack, a vinyl soundtrack of Plan 9, and he was flattering my uncle. He was exalting his work. You know, and I think in a way Ed Wood felt very guilty that he stiffed a little guy in a chair. But Ed Wood was instrumental in helping Gordon expand his business into feature films. And very close after he worked with Ed Wood, he got an MGM movie where they needed soundtracking. And so within like 24 months or something, Gordon was working with Doris Day on an MGM rom-com and working with Ed Wood on a movie where the spaceship is a hubcap. Yeah. So, you know, right. Welcome to Hollywood, kid.
Welcome to Hollywood. All right, one more Hollywood tale, Lucille Ball. Connect the dots.
Some of the projects that Gordon was working on, some of the TV shows, was filmed at Desilu Studios. Desilu used to be one of the hottest most successful studios around. I mean,
Star Trek.
Yeah, and go back and IMDb. It's really, there should be a for sure feature film done on Desilu, run by two squabbling but loving, you know, spouses. This is when I Love Lucy was going on, but for some reason Lucille Ball just thought my uncle was the cat's pajamas. It must have been my uncle's attitude, that non-pitting, let's do something. You know, Gordon was very interested in new technologies. He was pitching like crazy, and my older brother, who would sometimes go with my uncle down to the studios, said Lucille Ball would yell, "Gordon!" and come running up for him. And you could see kind of her red hair flare. Lucille Ball was not a pretentious person. She didn't. What wasn't for false pleasantries. And she would hug Gordon and chat him up, bring over other stars. And it was almost like a fangirl of my uncle. Hmm. And it's sad that they never worked on a project together. I know they kept in touch. And Lucille Ball, you know, who was really a trailblazer as both a producer, businesswoman, star, you know, she was a captain of the star system herself. She just thought Gordon was something great. And, I'm sure other people couldn't help but notice, wow, if one of America's best known TV actresses feel this way about him, there must be a magic attached to Gordon.
That's right. All right. So as we kind of wind down here, the other thing that I think is very important is tell folks a little about how you put a story like this back together. Because, I mean, as you say, you were 14 when your uncle passed.
Right.
Oddly, the same age again that he was when he had his accident. And it was years before you really became enchanted with all this. How do you put a story like this together? There were a lot of clips. There was a lot of newspaper coverage of his accident and of the trial, but the press as we know it today didn't really exist. He wasn't being covered the same way. How do you put the story together with such incredible detail?
It was I left a great newspaper job to do this book and to become an author. The editor of the paper I worked was very upset with me for quitting less than 2 years in the job. Said, you know, the great things we could have done together if you would have stayed. But I just had this otherworldly yearning to write my uncle's story. And so I left the newspaper job, started freelancing, and then I realized I'm screwed. I don't, you know, most of Gordon's business documents had been thrown away. My Gordon's wife, Judy, who outlived him for 14, 15 years, her address book her Rolodex and my uncle's Rolodex were ditched. Mm. You know, IMDb was in its infancy. And I had to spend about a month of dogged reporting work just to find the date of Gordon's accident. Once I found the date of his accident at Sierra Madre Public Library, the floodgates opened up, you know, to an extent. So I would have had to spend months getting, you know, in the microfiche department at libraries. You know, when I put together, like a journalist tracking an investigative story, a list of contacts, and I knocked on doors and I made phone calls and I did cold calling. And, you know, I found people, associates of Gordon, that would take me in, and I found others that would hang up on me and say, "I can't talk to you, kid. I'm dying." When I went to interview Jimmy, Gordon's longtime aide, friend, confidant, everything man, he was living in Shreveport, Louisiana. I flying down there thinking, okay, this is going to be the mother load. He had had a stroke between the time we arranged the interview and the time I actually set foot in Louisiana. So it was extremely hard. You know, a lot of the best meat of the material had faded away in time. And so I just had to take what I could. I cobbled it together. Like all writers, my first draft wasn't very good. But I had interest from a big New York publisher quite early on in doing it. And I got cocky. You know, all the success I had as a reporter, I thought, well, it's just going to naturally flow into being an author. That wasn't the case. 9/11 happened. Memoir biography was no longer the number one genre. It became about national security and then the Great Recession. It was hard to tell the story. I struggled with how much truth to work in, how much dirty laundry to air. My mom, you know, who passed away in 2012, wouldn't talk to me for a while because I wanted to write the naked, raw, unvarnished truth because I thought that would ultimately elevate Gordon, warts and all. But she didn't like me talking about murder or cancer or her father's affair or marital breakup, you know, et cetera.
Really? Mom didn't want to get into that stuff. I find that amazing.
My mom, as I've said, she wanted a Lifetime movie. I wanted an R-rated biography. And the more sex, drugs, flying out of planes, cutting off your hands, the better. And it took me a long time to understand how to write the story to its truest way. So that's why I try to tap into my own experiences with, you know, going into the hospital, seeing Gordon ill. If I had not been a journalist who knew how to get records, I don't think I could have ever done this story. So I felt like I was well prepared and set up to eventually find the truth. And, you know, one of my greatest epiphanies here is that though my last name is Jacobs, I'm a Zoller at heart. I'm that creative Hungarian moody quote artist. You know, I was a writer in a journalist body, kind of like my uncle was an idea man in a little handicapped frame. And you know, so it's, you know, it was a long process, and it took a while to develop a voice as well. You know, when you're a journalist, everybody's voice kind of sounds the same in a newspaper, but when you're an author, it's all yours to create from scratch. Hmm.
Well, folks, listen, it's a fascinating book. It's an incredible story. It's like I said to start, it's only in Hollywood kind of story, and it takes place in Hollywood, conveniently. You can order Chip Jacobs' new biography of his uncle, Strange as It Seems, The Impossible Life of Gordon Zoller, from great retailers everywhere, or you can get it right now at a great price from MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. If you're watching the show on MrMedia.com, just below the video, either to the left or the right, you will see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. They'll take you to Amazon. You'll get a great price. And you can have it as an ebook immediately on Kindle, other devices, or you can have it delivered to you, you know, by tomorrow. In some places, you might be able to get it tonight. So do that. Chip, do you have a website, I guess?
I do, www.chipjacobs.com. I have lots of information, supplemental information about Gordon. I have a little mini documentary about my discovery of him, as well as book trailers, et cetera. You know, you can, it's a feast of Gordon mania on there. So check it out. And any agents that want to option for a book, I will give a 2% off if sale only today.
All right. Only today. And are you on social media, Twitter, Facebook, things like that?
I am. I have a Chip Jacobs author page, as well as Chip Jacobs 1 is my Twitter handle.
Great. All right. Well, Chip, fascinating to talk to you. Fascinating book. Wish you a lot of luck with it. And thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
It was my pleasure. I hope my other author friends will discover you. You asked superb questions. So thank you so much.
Is recorded live before a studio audience full of musical geniuses who had no idea how good their lives were until reading Strange as It Seems in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.